Hey, Evan and Thomas, thanks so much for joining me. We are talking Garena Free Fire, the secret to the success for that game. And maybe we could all just go ahead and jump right in terms of the massive success of Free Fire. If you were to characterize what they did right, and by the way, for the audience, you guys have done some incredible deep dive and created like this 87-page initial research report followed up by another report. I'll put links to that, but given how much time, energy, and effort you guys have looked at Free Fire, what do you guys think? Why is Garena Free Fire so successful? What are they doing right? Hey folks, Joseph Kim here. I'm going to take you back to our conversation in just 1 minute, so hang on. But a quick note on our speakers. First, Thomas Baker has spent his career in mobile game design, including a 9-year stint at Electronic Arts, where he worked on a number of titles, but also acted as lead game designer on the hit Real Racing 3. And we also have Eva Grilova, who's also a very accomplished game designer, having worked on a number of titles at a number of studios, but notably Wooga and Social Point. Both Eva and Thomas are game design consultants at Novik, a games industry market research firm. Links to their bio in the show notes. And as a very special promotion starting today, meaning Novik, are offering their Garena Free Fire research report, super in-depth and really insightful report for free. Link in the show notes. This is something that's literally worth, I believe, in the thousands of dollars, but you can get it free today. And make sure to also subscribe as well to Game Makers, a YouTube channel, newsletter, so you can get access to future deals just like this one. Now, taking you back to this in-depth and very expert conversation about how did Garena Free Fire become one of the world's most successful games of all time, check it out.
I can start with the business side of things. So like one of the biggest like cornerstones in this whole success story is definitely targeting mobile before anyone else did it. Like They started developing the game probably around the same time when Fortnite started. And by the time everyone was just looking at PC and mobile only came way later. While like when Garena was building Free Fire, it was intentionally aimed at mobiles, and it was intentionally aimed at low performing devices, which is something we will be talking about over and over again because it's a huge part of the story.
That mobile first design mentality clearly had benefits in terms of scaling down to low end devices, but they also brought that to bear when it comes to things like control scheme, gunplay. The amount of bullet drop, the recoil on the weapons, the amount of auto aim and kind of auto tracking of targets. So they thought pretty hard about how to take, shooters, which is a complex, in terms of inputs, it's a complex genre, and how to adapt that really effectively to the input method that's native to mobile as a platform.
And Tom, could you go into that in a little more depth? If you were to highlight some of the big changes gameplay-wise, could you kind of repeat some of the things that they changed and talk a little bit more about why you think that those were like good design choices for them?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, so I mean, they have adapted the controls first and foremost, but they also did a lot to the player count, for example, is 50, which is half of your conventional battle royale, which necessarily leads to shorter round times, which is better for mobile. It also means that the maps don't need to be as large, which means the assets are smaller, which means they don't take up as much memory. So it's less of a threat to stability on device, and it also doesn't take up as much space just in storage. So people are more likely to be okay downloading it in the first place, and then more likely to leave the app sitting around on their device when they're looking for free space. So there's a wide variety of benefits to be had just from that core central half player count decision. Had all sorts of benefits further down the track. Yeah. So I think it's that kind of thinking that they brought to bear, that really shows that they were targeting mobile players who tend to want shorter sessions. They want it to resolve in a manageable amount of time, because yeah, they're not sitting in front of their TV or whatever gaming. They're maybe on public transport or sitting at home. So yeah,
right. And Eva, I know that you had mentioned in terms of the timing, they were one of the first two mobile, and certainly Fortnite, when it finally did launch on mobile, out of like the top 100 grossing games, they might have been like the top number one or near the top, but from a device performance perspective, they were all the way at number 100, right? So to that point, they were the most, it was the most difficult to run Fortnite from a device kind of support perspective. Do you, like, from a regional perspective then, or can you speak to like some of the impact of that decision, both by Fortnite not to have a Fortnite Lite version for mobile, and how did that play out geographically?
Sure. So like, we did a lot of digging on this. I hope I can answer this well, but like, it feels a lot like Garena managed to serve markets that were completely underserved and completely under the radar for a long time. Like, I'm sure there was an intention to building a game for these low-end devices, which then again, like, it reaped a huge harvest in countries like Brazil or Mexico, in the Southeast Asia, recently also, or until recently also in India. So that was definitely intentional. And I think, or what we also mentioned in the report, is that before this, no one really, especially in the West, looked at these markets, right? Like, and like, Garena is sort of known for being very innovative and looking into what they can offer that no one else has offered yet. Like, they started as a digital publishing platform in 2009, and they brought together certain aspects that, like, I don't think were offered at the time, like community, chat, ability to just push a button and play your favorite games. They had a deal with Tencent, with Riot, so they were distributing games like Counter-Strike in Southeast Asia. So there's a lot of this knowledge that they accumulated over the years, and now they were using it. And hey, there's actually a lot of people that have these low-end devices all over the world. They want to play something.
Right. In terms of, like, to that point, maybe we could also even talk about a C, right? Which is Garena is operated by a Singaporean company, C. There's like three kind of operating companies. Garena is part of it. I think part of the advantage that you talked about was they were live operating other big games and gaining knowledge and things of that nature. But could you speak more about Garena itself or C?
Lightly. So basically, Garena is part of three big companies, which are all under the umbrella of C Limited. It's a public listed company on the New York Stock Exchange, which is it's a huge achievement for Forrest Lee, who's the founder. He's a very elusive man. There's one interview with him from 2009. Yeah. That's pretty much it. But he's the visionary behind all of these. And there's definitely something to be said about how much into the future he's looking, because, if we talk about the companies, so it's Garena, it's the digital gaming platform, then it's Shopee, which is sort of like, it's like Amazon for Southeast Asia. Expanding worldwide, or trying to these days, and C Money, which is digital e-commerce platform. And especially like for Shopee, which, like, the brand got registered around the same time when Free Fire started development. So there was definitely some thinking around maybe knowledge in one area can, like, in digital distribution, in, I don't know, network setup, whatever, can help us propel these other businesses. But I have to say that for me, it's also a little bit of a mystery. Like, it's too visionary, you know, like, you're thinking like, oh, well, no one else is doing that. Like literally no one else is doing that in the whole world. So, but besides the intentions, like the story that happened was pretty much that Free Fire caught fire. And the money from that then helped propel these companies that require like huge starting capital, right? And it's way easier or more convenient to have that capital at hand than to run funding and stuff like that. So at certain point where Garena was, or where Free Fire was making a lot of money, that of course gives you a lot of freedom to experiment. And if you're a visionary entrepreneur, you're probably going to succeed.
Yeah. It feels like that their organizational structure and their roots helped them in the beginning, to your point, Eva, in terms of the ability to then live operate games, gain knowledge, expertise from that experience. But then to your point about there's these two other kind of, or you know, these two other divisions, and a lot of the Garena Free Fire revenue or profits are kind of, you know, being used to subsidize those businesses which aren't profitable. Like if we were to potentially run into a situation where the shooter market becomes intensely competitive and margins drop, you could then think potentially about a situation in the future where the C organizational structure could then make it actually more of a negative rather than positive. But, you know, just kind of speculation on my part. But maybe kind of going back to the gameplay itself and what Garena has done right since that initial phase where, you know, they were early to market, they had the right strategy supporting lower end devices. But then if you were to think about some of the key differentiation, how they were able to compete against some of these massive other players, right? Whether it's Fortnite, PUBG, Call of Duty Mobile, and, you know, more recently, we've got a bunch of new entrants, Apex Legends Mobile, you know, Valorant Mobile's being worked on or has been worked on for a while. So that'll be coming. There's going to be another Call of Duty mobile shooter game, Battlefield. Like, could you speak to kind of like maybe with respect to some of the bigger games, what you think is a primary differentiation between them and what they're doing well? And then maybe also, what do you think about the potential impact of this new wave of shooters all hitting the market that are kind of, you know, battle royale focused?
So I'm going to take the first part of the question and okay. just like mention the regions because I, what Garena, like the expertise they gained while they were operating games like Counter-Strike in Southeast Asia is also like that there are different countries, different cultures, which have different requirements, and they really leverage this with Free Fire. We can see that, like, I think the most shining example is Brazil. I think they also got fairly lucky there. Like it really spread incredibly. Like they were there, like the peak DAU in Brazil was 28 million players in a country with population of 210. So it's like,
wow,
a lot of people in Brazil were playing Free Fire at the same time. Like Garena is notorious for building local teams in locations like Sao Paulo, like Mexico City, and catering, like building localized and local flavors into the events and into the game. So they were really like looking at the audience and saying, oh, this is what you need. We're going to give it to you because, well, if we will, it's going to be good for us. And the numbers speak for themselves. It was good for them for a certain amount of time.
Right. So like the lower end device strategy, and you're saying a big part was just a lot of the localized stuff that they did.
Running local esports, like all of that, like, hey, we have a community here and we're just going to cater to it as much as we can.
And beyond that, getting, you know, local streamer, you know, celebrities to endorse the game, you know, building up that profile with, you know, people that region is familiar with and already care about. And I'm pretty sure that this hyper-localized mentality was brought to bear on each region. So they're each kind of somewhat their own separate silo in terms of the talent that's used to spruik the game, but also in terms of the cosmetics and the live events that are promoted in each region. There's content that is specifically catering to each given culture that ties into real world cultural events that are specific to that area. And that, you know, that's the kind of thing that makes people feel like this is a game that understands them, that, you know, it gives them more marketing beats to hook into when they're promoting the game and running UA. So, yeah, obviously it's the kind of thing that you only have the privilege of being able to do when you already have a big budget and a big team, but you also have to have the foresight and the organizational capacity to actually execute that strategy successfully and think to do it in the first place as well. So it's not just
something. This is something they already tried with the Garena platform, with like League of Legends and Thailand. They already run like, hey, this is a specific character that we created just for you, just for this specific audience, someone, a local star. Like, and they did this a lot again with Free Fire, like also heavily in India, in Brazil, like building characters based on Bollywood stars and stuff like that. Like, so they really know what they're doing in this area.
Right. And just to kind of repeat and clarify some of the localization initiatives that Garena implemented, if I'm understanding correctly, it sounds like what they did were specific localized cosmetics, specific localized characters. And Tom, you also mentioned events. So maybe like, you know, for the specific location, various kinds of holidays and things like that. But was there anything else, or do you think those are the three main forms of localization?
I think it's those, and it's also running like events like on the ground, like area specific esports tournaments, that kind of thing, to really foster a culture of high and level competition.
And it's also interesting how like differently it works in different countries. Like, we can definitely talk about US, because that's, I think, one of the most interesting stories about Garena or about Free Fire. But for instance, like for instance, in Brazil, the virality was huge. Like, you can really see like the crazy amount of DAUs, like in comparison, for instance, with another LATAM country, which is fairly big for Garena, that's Mexico. It's still huge. So there are definitely some cultural factors to how the game spreads, which was again like really, really leveraged in Brazil. And I think like partially it was just sort of sheer luck, but at the same time, luck is there for the ones who are sort of prepared, right? And like also in Brazil, there was this like whole, it sort of became this dream, you know, like based on the socio-economic factors, like it became this dream of I can become an influencer, I can become rich. Like, there were stories of influencers getting huge almost literally overnight. And for Brazil, which is huge and diverse, and there's a certain an underserved population when it comes to games, but also a population which is poor, there's this dream of course, like getting out of that, right? And for a long time in Brazil, this was the dream of becoming a soccer star. Like, that's a very nationwide dream. And at some point, this got replaced by becoming a Free Fire influencer or a Free Fire star. Like, I've seen, sorry, like, I'm gonna wrap up. I've seen surveys from the favelas, like, which games do you know? And 100% of the audience would name Free Fire and potentially no other game. Like, this is the kind of impact they caught on, and it was huge.
Right. And when you think about, for example, going back to that second part of the question, which is really about competitive landscape and how you would potentially think about the differentiation between Fortnite, PUBG, and Call of Duty Mobile, for example, in this kind of current generation of competition, like, one thing that comes to my mind is that, you know, Fortnite got banned. They kind of, you know, for whatever reason, had the issues with Google Play, tried to launch their own store on Google Play, on Android. When you look at Call of Duty Mobile, it's, just from what I'm hearing, most of the gameplay is more TDM, Team Deathmatch, instead of Battle Royale. And so it seemed like when you think about competition to Garena Free Fire, it seemed like it's mainly PUBG. But I don't know if you guys would agree or disagree. And then maybe just to keep things complicated and adding to that, you know, how would you guys like characterize the competitive landscape in terms of the current market? And then again, going back to like this new wave of competition coming in, Apex Legends Mobile, Valorant, Battlefield, how do you think that then changes the competitive landscape with these new guys jumping in?
Well, I think, Free Fire, yeah, I think I agree. I think the primary competitor is PUBG. I think that what Free Fire still has over the competition is, really excellent performance on low-end devices. Any competitor that's aiming to make a dent in that is going to have to scale down and accommodate that demand in tier two and three audiences. And even in tier one countries, we see from the numbers that there is clearly a demand for a battle royale experience that is polished and also runs well on, I believe, mid-tier devices, Android devices in the US, like is a big opportunity that Free Fire has managed to capitalize on. So the like wide device compatibility feels like table stakes for me to really pose a threat to Free Fire to its specific market. I think you would also need to be employing the same kind of short round mentality as Free Fire has employed, and we've seen that come about in PUBG New State, which was utilizing one of the modes that they were rolling out shortly after launch, which is a little while ago now, appeared to be very much mimicking this Free Fire approach of trying to keep things tight, keep them snappy, keep things resolving rapidly. You know, the player count is down, high quality loot, that kind of thing. So, you'd need to do what Free Fire is doing, and then present some kind of compelling competitive advantage. And one thing that we haven't talked about yet is, arguably a strength and a weakness, as is arguably pretty much any game design decision. On Free Fire's part is their heavily diversified monetization avenues. So they have the cosmetic side of things locked down, as do all the battle royales, really, the really big ones. But what they have that the others don't, and this was probably the most interesting part of the analysis for me, was that they're selling power. So they're not only making you look cool, but they're making you more powerful. And they do that very cleverly, and we can talk about why, but essentially I think probably the greatest risk to Free Fire is Free Fire itself, in the sense that by allowing players to pay for competitive advantage, they're clearly making good money out of that. But if someone comes along with a more fair, more level playing field oriented option that is also accessible to people's devices and also has snappy gameplay with very accessible controls, gunplay, and that kind of thing, accessible round times, then I think that could pose a real threat. As for the specifics of those competitors that you mentioned, Apex, I'm actually not sure how well that core gameplay translates to mobile. I haven't delved deeply into the mobile version yet. On PC, on HD, it's a more nuanced experience than your average battle royale. Whereas Free Fire has gone the less is more kind of approach. I'm not convinced that poses a threat, but I haven't looked at the numbers, so I shouldn't speak too confidently there. Battlefield Mobile, we haven't even seen a reveal trailer, so that's a while off yet. It has a fairly different audience, aesthetically speaking, at least. Battlefield caters to the authentic, authenticity-oriented crowd. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how quickly they jump the shark there. Yeah, I suspect that just, you know, you can't get over a billion downloads and have all of those players churn out and then expect to keep kind of bulldozing forward at that same pace while still making money out of kind of disrupting the integrity of the competition, I don't think. So, yeah, I suspect it'll be the game itself that undermines its future.
I can talk about that. So by the time we released the report, the numbers were like talking specifically about DAU and revenue. They were, let's say, falling down a little bit, but not heavily. But now we're half a year later, and I can say for sure that it seems threatening. Like, the absolute peak for Free Fire was the August of last year. That was the largest DAU or monthly average users, and it was also when they were making the most money. And like, we were looking at something like 180 million DAU at that moment, and now we're at like 40. So I think that speaks a lot for how quickly the game is falling out. Mm-hmm. One thing that I don't know for sure, and I don't know if Tom looked into it, is that like, we don't know how much or how little the efforts on the live ops side have dwindled, right? Like, at some point, there is a point of no return when it no longer makes sense to run a very heavy operation. I don't think we're there yet. Like, they're still releasing seasons and everything, and the game's probably going to be running for a couple more years for the dedicated audience. But I think it's safe to say that it's way past its prime.
Yeah, so let's talk about a couple of these issues that you guys raised. I mean, kind of a couple of bombshells here, right? So first, this differentiation, Tom, that you mentioned about the monetization model in Garena Free Fire, which is dramatically, well, you know, you can characterize it for me, but I would consider, you know, potentially dramatically different from what fair to play players are expecting. And I think you talk about this in your report. You call it the, you know, they're monetizing in what you guys call the Goldilocks zone. So maybe we could start with that. But then I also want to get to the point that you raised, Eva, in terms of like the kind of decline now. And, you know, C did warn that they may be 40% down in terms of their overall gaming portfolio at their one of their financial analyst calls. But let's start with this sort of pay to win or the monetization model. Tom or Eva, could you guys break down the specific differentiation and how they are so different from let's say PUBG?
Yeah, sure. I'll take this one. It was the area that I focused on. So I described it as being in the Goldilocks zone, and what I meant by that is the competitive advantage that you can pay for is sufficiently large and appealing that it's worth paying for, but not so great that it actually undermines the integrity or fairness of the competition. Not too little, not too much, kind of just right influence over the outcome of any given match. And that's, part of the cleverness of the way that they've monetized power is kind of inherent. It's kind of baked into Battle Royale as a format for gameplay. There's a lot of randomization elements there. I'm sure the audience is probably quite familiar with how Battle Royale functions. There's randomized loot. You drop into a semi, a place that you choose, but your options are determined by a randomized flight path at the beginning of each round. So when you buy a weapon, you have any given weapon will be better than its base version, but not like obviously significantly better. It might be like, I don't know, 20, 40% better. It's not like you can upgrade guns and have this massive vertical progression where you can see that your gun X is 3 levels higher than this other person's gun X. So So when you buy a variant of a weapon, they add a couple of things that benefit it, like might be rate of fire and, you know, bullet drop reduction, and they might reduce the damage. So it's like, well, it's better, but it's not like roundly better. It's not categorically superior. It's something of a side grade, but it is obviously the superior option. And that has all sorts of benefits. First of all, it kind of tempers the sense of pay to win, which is a good thing. The other thing is it means that they can have many different versions of the same weapon for sale, and different versions might be preferable for different players or in different circumstances, or different maps, different modes. So that's useful as well, because it means that they can not just sell you an upgraded blah, they can sell you different upgraded blah. And then beyond that, once you get into a round, there's only so much chance that you will actually find one of the weapons that you have paid for. So just because you have, you know, half of the weapons in your inventory of, say, 50 guns might be these paid semi-upgraded variants, it's the luck of the draw. It's where you choose to loot, where you choose to drop, that determines whether you get to take advantage of those. And then beyond that, there's the fact that when you encounter another player or players in Battle Royale, inherent in the relatively freeform nature of that is you don't know whether you're going to engage them solo, whether you're going to come across an entire squad. Are they going to get the jump on you? Are you going to be like on a hillside that's heavily forested, or in a like claustrophobic urban environment? Are you going to be out in the open? So there are all these variables that contribute to different weapons being more or less useful, and just having paid for them doesn't mean that you're definitely going to win. So that's part of what contributes to this Goldilocks element.
In your research report, you kind of allude to this concept that I think you called orthogonal utility.
Yeah.
Is that, and you kind of compared it to something that you called categorical superiority. Is that a good example of that?
Basically the orthogonal utility, like the classic example is, I don't know, chess is an okay example. The bishop has fundamentally different benefits to the bishop. Did I say the same thing twice? Orthogonal utility is about basically different things having different uses in different circumstances. And just because you have a fully stacked SMG, if you pick that up and then you encounter someone out in the open and they have a default sniper rifle, then they're probably gonna take you out. There are many subtle ways that you can pay for advantage, but they don't all combine to collectively increase your chances of winning in any given encounter, but they're beneficial enough that they're seriously worth considering. And then there's this separate layer to it, which I found really interesting, which is the temporary nature of a lot of the power that you can pay for. Temporary cosmetics are also a big part of what the game does. It's not unusual, certainly not unusual in Korean games. They've been around for a while. It is certainly more prevalent in Free Fire. And the fact that the power that you pay for is also given a time limit means that just because you bought such and such thing, a week later you no longer have access to it. So they can afford to charge you a small amount for something that's quite useful, but then you'll kind of essentially have to subscribe to that power on an ongoing basis if you want to consistently leverage and increase your chances of winning.
And here, like, if you come back to what the competition can do better, it's definitely that also this behavior and this particular Battle Royale was the first, like, game of this genre for a lot of people that saw the game, right? So as soon as they sort of realized that, like, things don't have to be this greedy or this pay to win. Of course, like that's another reason to leave the game.
Right.
Yeah. So, and it's and the inverse of that is if you're already in love with PUBG, then you play Free Fire and you see that your opponents have paid to beat you and what they paid for is something that they don't get to keep. The chances of you being like, oh yeah, this is the battle royale for me. This is something that I'm going to invest in heavily. Yeah, it just seems pretty slim. So when you have a captive audience, like they did in the tier 2 and 3 regions that they really aggressively captured early on, then these things are competitive advantages. But when that same audience is exposed to an alternative, or that audience in a different region has a prospect of jumping to your product, to Free Fire, I think it kind of inverts and becomes a competitive disadvantage.
Got it. So going now to that second part, Eva, you had mentioned the decline, and I think you guys go into it in more depth in your report, but since like August 2021, I think you guys have been showing a decline. I mentioned before, C itself has warned that there may be a 40% drop in Garena, maybe like a 30% drop or something like that. But for this year, what are you guys seeing? And maybe we can even follow up to your point, Tom, about because of the pay-to-win mechanics that potentially fueled a lot of the profits that they generated in, you know, to now, is that a risk for them? Does that pose a risk for them to continue to fall, especially as we see more and more entrants enter the market? What do you think, Eva?
Right. So like, yeah, as I mentioned, like by the time we were releasing the report, the decline started to be tangible, but there was still like, it was unclear how it's going to continue. So now we're half a year later and it's very tangible. It's very visible. So like, for instance, in Brazil, the game is sort of like falling off, and I'm not sure if it makes sense to talk about the actual numbers, right? But like, it's obvious that the audience has pretty much like dwindled to a very small degree what it used to be. An interesting case that we haven't really spoken about yet is the United States. And so when we were looking into the numbers and into how different markets perform, one thing that was very, very interesting was that actually, like, it was clear from the start that Garena tried to capture Southeast Asia, they tried to capture LATAM, and they definitely succeeded there. But one of the like side effects of developing for low-end devices was also capturing a huge Android base in the United States. And that was the sort of interesting thing, because when you look at, I don't know, the ratio of devices used for PUBG, it's going to be more or less half-half, maybe slightly higher for iOS even. But for Free Fire, it's like 5 to 10% of iOS users, and then the rest is like this overwhelming mass of Android users. And unlike the markets that Garena captured early on, like the interest from the States like about Free Fire only happened with COVID. Like there's a very clear trend, like March 2020, the numbers are going up. And particularly revenue, that there wasn't even such a huge amount of players. Like actually, like that's also something we can maybe show, it's that at the time of writing the report, like a third of all revenue was coming from the United States, while only 2% of all players were coming from there. And that's like already in the report we mentioned that this is sort of risky, because first it's in the market which is sort of unknown to Garena, right? Like they know how to operate on their own turf, they know how to operate in Southeast Asia, but this felt more, way more accidental. And one of the things that speaks for like maybe Garena not expecting that was that English-speaking esports tournament only happened for the first time like in April 2021. So while they were like running esports tournaments for 3 years already in India, in Brazil, serving the English-speaking audience came way later. And so by the time of the report, US was contributing about 1/3 of revenue. Right. And we can see that this has also fallen off drastically. And like it's been nice while it lasted, but it's no longer there. And like you asked what factors contribute into this. Like, I think a big chunk is really that the players are sort of like wasted, right? Like they're tired of the game or they're not playing it anymore, which we can see in the AU. But also in lots of countries, like I would again point out Brazil, like I think it's safe to say that everyone who would be potentially interested in the game already has seen it and has tried it and has played it. Like, I think the total of downloads in Brazil is like 150 million, even if there will be something ascribed to, I don't know, you know, double accounts and stuff like that. It's still like it's 200 million population. So that's a lot of downloads and you can't really, you know, get more. Right. And in US, probably I would assume that again, like, you know, things are freeing up. People no longer spend time in front of their phones or computers. That's definitely going to play a role as well. And to add another little story on top of that, like, for instance, in Southeast Asia itself, the decline has been also fairly tangible. Also, like it, all the decline curves sort of copy themselves. Like the peak, the worldwide peak last August, and then things are sort of falling off. There is a couple of interesting stories that are very hard to explain. That sort of like set my brain on fire while doing the report. Like for instance, at some point in Indonesia, the revenue just drops off to a fourth and never recovers. And I spent ages trying to like understand why. Like, was there a lockdown imposed? Was there a lockdown opened, released? Was there another game released? But it doesn't really make sense. Like, I think like the theory I'm sort of fine with is maybe something happened in the game itself, maybe a technical factor that, I don't know, maybe had an impact for a couple of hours or days. And meanwhile, like players sort of, you know, churned because they lost like their main activity. I don't know, but it's safe to say that like for instance in Indonesia again, like the adoption of the digital world of mobile devices is still on a very strong upward trend. Like 26% new mobile users or mobile gamers actually between 2021. That's also like a very, you know, steep upward trend, but it also comes with a heavy push for local development, for local investments and locally built games, which of course will take away some of that audience as well. So that's also like a reason why for instance in there, like in this region, it's not just the case for Indonesia, but it's a good showcase case. Is that like the local development is taking over and like the local digitalization is a strong trend and heavily, I'm not sure I would say subsidized, but definitely heavily looked on by, you know, the government. Hey, there's some official money. We can make local development. We can create local jobs. We can create local games.
Hmm. I think it's part of a broader kind of decolonialization, digital decolonialization. I think there are some macro trends at play in its decline. There's the COVID hangover factor where like everything that involved being able to socialize online blew up in 2020-2021. That can't possibly persist. You know, what goes up must come down. So the numbers don't compare favorably almost by default. Battle Royale itself as a genre, you know, has burned very brightly for a while now. But I think, I know it's on a steady decline as a whole. But there's one other game specific aspect that we haven't talked about beyond, you know, the probability that this pay to win component is biting them, now, which is, the game is so incredibly, or has been so incredibly heavily updated that the live events that they run, the complexity that they inject into the game on a monthly basis in terms of varied micro meta games, in terms of season specific gameplay, that they're absolutely thrashing the live ops, and that is on one hand admirable, but we did analysis of reviews and, you know, kind of common search terms and ratings. And it became evident that there is an increasing number, there are an increasing number of players complaining about instability, about data loss, about, you know, loss of performance. So essentially, I think what's going on is they are running so fast that they are tripping over themselves, that you can only be so robust with your QA. You can only shove so many new assets into the game without some of it basically causing trouble and tech debts mounting up. So I think, you know, it doesn't matter how cool or interesting or fresh your game is from week to week, month to month, if it doesn't work or you lose all your, you know, sweet cosmetics or your profile data, that's an instant game killer. You know, that could cause a heavy spender to churn immediately if they lose their stuff. So I think, yeah, they've kind of run so fast that they're actually causing themselves trouble. And that actually, and I can't substantiate this, but my kind of player experience brain says, if the player has to continually learn and relearn what it is to be optimal at this game, you know, constantly solve a new efficiency puzzle every week or every month in order to excel at the game and compare favorably with other players, or just feel like you have satisfied that need to be efficient, then it's going to take a cognitive toll over time. So on the one hand, it probably keeps the game fresh and keeps people engaged. On the other, it probably burns them out gradually. So, you know, yet another case of like, you use a particular tool in the game design toolbox, it has pros and cons, and then, you know, like often
right. inversions it, that, of one so that's another. Really interesting. I mean, I could certainly see the first reason that you talked about with like COVID hangover. And we certainly saw, like, even when you look at social casino games, for example, as soon as the stimulus checks hit in the US, and you mentioned that there's a dramatic increase in terms of monetization from the US, we saw big spikes in some of those games in terms of spend. So that part makes sense. And I can see that part declining. But I really thought that some of the other points that you guys had brought up in terms of maybe it is like this pay to win aspect, and possibly, to your point, the technical instability, just because they're potentially trying to put so much in so fast, that may also be leading to a potential decline. So that's really interesting to hear about. And maybe the one other thing it'd be great to talk about would also be this issue with Free Fire Max. And, you know, we saw, you know, PUBG also release a new SKU, a new state, but could you maybe talk about some of your opinions in terms of Max, what they did right, what's your kind of like outlook on Max, and why do you think they launched Max in addition to Free Fire?
So I think Max is a really interesting case. For the listener, basically Max is like a quote ultra HD version of the game. It's essentially the same game. It's same gameplay, same live ops, same economy. Your save data transfers between the two versions of the game. So that it is Free Fire, but it's Free Fire under a different app ID with different, more high res assets, better visual effects. And the one interesting case where the functionality differs is in Craftland, which is this level editor that they built in, which, you know, presumably was too resource hungry for lower end devices, or maybe just a key differentiator to try and encourage people to check out the new version. But so the existence of Max is interesting, partially because it's something that I don't know that anyone else has really done. If you look at PUBG, for example, I remember there being 9 different SKUs. You know, that is a game that is highly fragmented across different regional specific implementations of that IP, that kind of genre of game. And, you know, there are benefits to that approach, but the real win with the Free Fire and Free Fire Max is there's no fragmentation of player base. So you can play against your friend who has a higher end or lower end device seamlessly. They don't have to worry about, you know, cannibalizing in terms of concurrency of players, that kind of thing. But what's not, you know, super clear is why they released it as a separate app, because they, I'm not a technical person, but, you know, it seems to me like unless there's some fundamental underlying like engine or asset management reason, there's no reason they couldn't have done the same thing in the same app and just had it detect your device and enable or disable various functions and VFX and assets on that basis. So my theory is that it's essentially a marketing move. Like they did this because they thought that it would light up the Free Fire brand. They could launch it as a new thing, draw a lot of attention, get people to reinstall the game where otherwise they might have just been like not even known that it existed as a new set of assets and this high fidelity experience. I think broadly it's like a reacquisition profile spiking maneuver on Garena's part.
Eva, do you agree with that?
Yeah, yeah, obviously I do. But like, it's also funny because like this sort of idea, maybe some people will come over. Actually, one of the two drops in the AU that happened over the last half a year was the release of Free Fire Max, and it wasn't really compensated. So you see people leaving the original game, you see people paying less than the original game, but it never picks up in Max. So like, that's also like a story we can speculate on. Maybe people jumped over, so it's exactly the same and it was the last throw for them. But in terms of like that expectation, I don't think it really delivered. Mm.
All right. Well, I have one last question. So Garena Free Fire longer term, given how much you guys have researched the game, the company, what do you think we should expect from Garena Free Fire in the future? And are there things that you think that they should be doing right now to improve Free Fire?
So like, this is an interesting question and I'm really not sure, because like my general anticipation would be like they have built this mass network, they have all this knowledge, they know how to run live ops, they have the local studios everywhere. So like, to me, it sounds like trying to develop something new would make sense. I was sort of like looking into what jobs they post, if that has changed over time, and there's not really any indication of some like strong activity, which doesn't have to necessarily mean anything in case like they either have the teams in place, but also pointing out that Free Fire was not actually developed by Garena, but by a Vietnamese studio they sort of outsourced it to. So like, at least originally the whole game was not developed by Garena, and like, that's really not clear if they have capacity to do something like that. Like, my guess would be more inclined to say yes. But whether they're like, at this point, it makes more sense to be thinking how to utilize all that knowledge than to, you know, try to revive Garena, Free Fire. One thing is that it could follow a similar pattern as Shopee does. So with Shopee, they have success in Southeast Asia, but now they're also trying to get into other markets like Brazil or France. There can be potentially still some untapped audiences for Free Fire. For instance, I think Turkey was sort of on a rise by the time we were doing the report. I actually haven't checked how it's looking now. So I think it could still potentially think about certain markets, but that sort of mass success is past us. And I'm not really sure how to answer this how to answer this question. Okay. Like, Tom can speak for within the game. I can speak more on the outside scheme. It would be weird if they weren't at least prototyping, is my opinion. Like, why not? Because they could come in with something completely new relatively easily, and they have the distribution channels, which I think is the most important part in this case.
Yeah. What do you think, Tom?
So my sense is that, I mean, I think they would do well to avoid burning out any more of their players with performance issues and technical problems. I mean, it's always risky. You're running on the treadmill. That's what keeps people engaged. Do you take the time to slow down and shore up your defenses, to mix metaphors, to try and retain people, or do you keep running as fast as you have been and hope that they stick around despite, you know, the bumps in the road? I would probably be inclined to say they should be at very least in parallel trying to really meaningfully address the tech debts that they've accrued. So that would probably be, I think that should be a priority for them. In terms of more like interesting broad product strategy moves they could make, another possible theory for the development of Max, or a way to build on the development of Max, is some time ago they acquired, I can't remember the name of the studio, maybe Phoenix Labs.
Phoenix Labs.
Yeah. So they put out a free-to-play kind of Monster Hunter that's cross-platform called Dauntless. And perhaps the effort that was taken to up-res the assets for Max was a step towards going like properly cross-platform. And come out on HD and perhaps recapture some of the market that Fortnite has kind of left behind, because to my knowledge, it was the only true cross-platform battle royale,
right,
or at least the only really big one. I think there are probably other instances, but they haven't blown up. So what if they took all the assets, the VFX and so on, utilize the expertise of cross-platform play that they have from Dauntless and stepped into the shoes that Fortnite vacated a year or so ago. So that's one interesting possibility. Another is they do what it seems like almost everyone is doing these days and kind of go transmedia, you know, release a TV show or, you know, put out a movie. They already have some pretty slick video production capabilities that they bring to bear on their marketing materials. So I can imagine that they could perhaps repurpose them or just outsource development further and try and turn Free Fire into a universe unto itself. And they also have this quite weird, interesting thing that's a bit like, you know, the Gorillaz, the band that's a virtual band made up of, you know, a super group of regular band members, but it's, you know, as a performance, it only exists in its kind of virtual form. Potentially they could, so Free Fire has a virtual band, and I can imagine they might try and build out the cultural cachet of the brand by having that band go on tour or something like that. There's all sorts of, you know, pop culture crossover happening between these juggernauts of social competitive games and other forms of popular cultural expression. So I can see them potentially trying to capitalize on that. And then one kind of long shot possibility is they take, you know, what might soon be a husk of a game in Free Fire and run some kind of crypto related experiments on it to see if people are interested in like trading cosmetics. And they take, you know, take a cut from each marketplace transaction or something. And then, you know, depending on the outcome of that as a product experiment, and, you know, working out what the pipeline is and what are the regulatory limitations of, you know, what will Apple and Google actually tolerate being present on their platform in a high profile game, relatively high profile, and then bringing all that knowledge to bear on whatever they might be prototyping right now. But that's probably a long shot. I'm not sure I would sacrifice the golden goose to that god just yet, but they might be considering it.
Yeah, a lot of really interesting ideas that you bring forward. And I definitely think the Phoenix Labs acquisition, for them to go to HD, that one really seems like that would make a lot of sense for them to do. But
yeah, all right. And it's something that they're relatively well positioned to do compared to the competition.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Everyone else is sitting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, Eva and Tom, thank you so much for your time. Just to wrap this up, for people out there in the audience who want to get in touch with you, how can they do that? And do you have a final message for anyone out there listening?
I'm not on Twitter, which is kind of weird, but there you go. Yeah, but but I am on LinkedIn, you know, Thomas okay. Baker.
And I'll leave a link.
Yeah, awesome.
Same for me. Not by Thomas Baker, Eva Grilova. On LinkedIn as well.
Okay.
And final message, I don't know. I hope you enjoyed our analysis and the podcast. And if ever you want some consulting services or juicy deconstructions, Navik Pro, hit us up.
I'll definitely leave a link to that as well. Tom awesome. And Eva, thank you so much. And for our audience, we will catch you next time. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.